You're listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 31. And we have a really packed show for you tonight, as always. Our special guest is the incredible Blair Cottrell, who we will be interviewing and introducing very soon. We only have a couple of short announcements. Last night, Laura was fantastic over on TR Talk. She did an amazing job over there, and I am on TR Talk tomorrow talking to Chris and putting over the ethno-nationalist point of view. So please support me there. I'll be tweeting about that tomorrow. I will be talking at a later date about the Patriotic Alternative Christmas parties. They're now in full swing. One of them's already taken place in London. It was a great success, and there's more of them coming. I will keep you updated on them. And we will be doing two general election streams, both next week. One on Monday with myself, Morgoth, Zurius, and Laura, discussing the general election in its entirety, who you should vote for, a bit of a lowdown on the candidates. And then we'll be doing a follow-up stream to that on the Friday, where we discuss how it turned out and what the implications of the result are for the country as a whole. So there'll be two general election streams next week. So that is it for announcements. Now, straight over to Jason. What have you been up to this week, my friend?
Well, Mark, I must say we had an enormous event last night. The big awards for the video, Last Message to the West, and you all can get over there and still watch it at lastmessagetothewest.com. And I won't, we revealed the top five winners. A significant sum of money was distributed to all of the winners of these videos. It was very exciting. But what's most exciting about it is that this was a great victory for the community in service to white well-being, because so many folks came together. This was Lovely Porridge's original idea. It started with him, and he immediately roped in the great Jared George. They worked together, and before you knew it, people were coming in from continent after continent in service to white well-being, and they contributed their time, their talents, some of them their money. Obviously, we ended up, of course, Roy Danton ending the contributions to the prize winners with a last minute $500 investment to the prize winners. It was just absolutely magnificent. I think we ended up with 29 videos, all of them beautifully done, and can reach people that you know in ways that only they can be reached. So if you head on over to that website, you'll be able to still find those videos, and then you'll be able to use them for yourself, for your friends or family. And a big salute to everyone who participated in that. We had a lot of fun last night distributing those awards and talking about runners up and all of that sort of thing. But today it is magnificent to be with Blair. So much has come to me about this gentleman here and the good work that he is doing. Been recommended a great many times, heard his name over and over. So I'm delighted to be here with him. And of course, our leader, the great Mark Collette, and Dr. Patrick Slattery, the all-knowing encyclopedia of the white positive sphere, and everyone out there in the chat today. I'm already seeing some great names and beautiful ladies. So I will pass it back to Mark.
Thank you. Now, Patrick, what have you been up to this week, my friend?
Well, obviously, I got the week started off right with a interview with Mark Collette on the National Bugle Radio. That's always a great way to start the week. And I do my National Bugle Radio show. Last week, we had an interview with Kevin McDonald. I haven't gotten it on BitChute yet, but hopefully by the end of the broadcast, maybe I'll have it up on BitChute. So that's all been good. And I'm very, you know, I'm a big Aussiephile, actually. Steve Irwin and the Wiggles and all these people, these are my heroes. And I had a bunch of Australian friends, and I played footy for a while. I played footy, and it's an insane game. only could be invented by people who spend most of their time upside down because, you know, north-south business. But no, it is so much fun. It's just a little bit insane for somebody my age to be running around. But one thing that I did learn is for somebody my age to run fast, it really helps to have a bunch of big, burly Australian guys chasing you around. So that's the good part. I don't do it anymore, but yeah, it kept me fast for a while. And so I'll pass it on back to Mark.
Okay, well, one last piece of news before we go over to Blair. If you want to contribute to the show, please do so using Entropy. The link for the Entropy chat is now in the main chat. It is also in the description of the show. It's on my Twitter and it is on my Telegram. Entropy is the only way you can make financial contributions to the show, and it is the only way you can ask questions to the panel. All questions are voted on, the best questions are voted up, and the questions at the top of the pile will be asked to the panel. Please keep all questions today. It's all going to be about Blair. This is about nothing else. It is about Blair. So if you're asking questions, please make them relevant to him or relevant to Australian politics or to things that he campaigns about, so we keep everything on topic. Now, I am going to introduce the man himself. Now, when I was younger, when I was of school age, Australia was known for three or four things. It was known for the soap opera Neighbours, it was known for Foster's Lager, it was known for kangaroos, and it was known for Kylie Minogue, who came out of the soap opera Neighbours. But now it is known for something much, much better, even better than Kylie Minogue or kangaroos. And that is, of course, the ultimate Australian Chad, Blair Cottrell. Now, when I first saw Blair Cottrell on the political scene, he was talking a lot about issues to do with Islam, issue to do with migration, and he has gone on to be one of the most woke people on our side of the political fence. He now talks about everything we talk about, and he's undergone an incredible political journey. And that is something that I really want to talk about tonight, because so many people are scared to follow the trail of breadcrumbs to the ultimate truth. But that isn't Blair at all. He has embraced the ultimate truth. He talks about so many different things. And because of the things he talks about, he is now the most censored man in Australian history. So without further ado, please introduce yourself. Please tell us where we can find your work. And please tell us how we can contribute to the great work that you do.
Okay, well, thanks for having me, first of all. Yeah, it is early in the morning here, as someone in the comments just said. It's not 3 a.m. I got up at about 4:30 in the morning. That's probably why I don't look as impressive as you guys. But, yeah, well, basically in 2015 is when I first engaged in the political realm. After having been, I suppose you could say, self-educated leading up to that, I joined in with a street movement organization, a grassroots political protest group called Reclaim Australia, and then we started the United Patriots Front out of that, because Reclaim Australia didn't turn out to be all that consistent. But we grew into the most popular grassroots working class activist group in the country very quickly. Within about a year, we had over 200,000 followers on Facebook, and my videos would get enormous amounts of reach. We got more attention than I was prepared for, actually. I didn't know what to do with it at first. I didn't have a long-term plan for this kind of movement, but I did what I could with it, and I used the platform to communicate not just what the media will tell you I communicated, which is anti-Islam, but it was my message was very critical of what I saw as institutional corruption at a state level, specifically in media, government, education system, law enforcement, and even military. It was a moral corruption, which I believed was destroying our country from the inside. And I think everybody's pretty familiar. Everybody who would watch Mark is pretty familiar with that kind of stuff. It's psych warfare, or an aspect of psych warfare. Because I went further than the no Islam type rhetoric, I am currently the most censored person in the country by far. I've had my Facebook account Twitter, YouTube, PayPal, and even my personal bank account closed. And I haven't been given reasons for any of this censorship, but yeah, you know what the reason is. It's because, you know, if you're going up against communists or Marxists, their whole world philosophy is based on such an intricate network of lies, and they can't have anybody telling the truth. So that's where I'm at now, which is just on Gab and Telegram. I haven't made BitChute yet, but I've been busy in and out of court over the past 2.5 years after I was charged by the state government for intent to incite ridicule of Muslims on Facebook. I was initially convicted of that charge at a lower level of court, but I didn't really spend money on lawyers at lower level because I thought it would be a waste. I knew it was probably going to go to a higher level, and that's what I wanted. It eventually went to county court, which is like mid-range in this country. That's when I got a lawyer, and that's when the state government pulled out all the stops, and that's when the media stopped reporting on it too at the same time. The Attorney General of Victoria, the state's highest ranking law expert, was summoned, and four other state prosecuting lawyers were up against me and my barrister, John Bolton. That trial just took place about 3 weeks ago, actually, even though mainstream media journalists chose to report that I failed the whole thing about a year ago, a year before it even began. It just finished 3 weeks ago, and we're still waiting to hear a result. We've made three major arguments, and they're all centered around, first of all, my innocence on the intent charge, because, as I said, I've been charged with intent to incite ridicule of Muslims, not actually inciting anything. So it's a thought crime. They've gone into my head and they've said, your intent is criminal. And also, we've argued that based on Australia's constitution, I have an implied right to political expression or political discourse, political and religious discourse. And under the UN, funnily enough, the UN Charter of Human Rights, I have the right to free expression. So we based our argument on those pieces of legislation or those laws, and we should be getting a result any day now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. That's pretty much it.
So at one time you were running the United Patriots Front, and we were talking about that before the show began, and that was something that was getting pretty big. That was something that was getting quite a lot of traction. It was something a lot of young men wanted to be involved in, and they've effectively attempted to shut that down by censoring you heavily, especially on Facebook. And you were telling me before the show, I really want my viewers to hear this directly from you. Tell the story about that, and tell, because you're telling me that now anyone that posts anything to do with you is basically banned immediately from Facebook. So it's almost like a single picture of you, the system recognizes it, and the person posting it is basically banned or is given some kind of infraction for doing that.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest things on Facebook at the time, my political platform that I created for us. I think the only person I can think of who grew faster at the time was Milo Yiannopoulos. But we kept up with him. Like, our growth was happened just before or around the same time as his on Facebook. And I think we were one of the first Facebook pages at the time to get hit with this worldwide censorship phenomenon in 2016, in early 2016, actually. It was reported on by the media at the time, because back then we still got at least contacted by mainstream media for the purposes of slandering us. And so they were always happy to see something bad happening to us. So they reported on it and gloated about it. These days they don't report on anything at all. It's not allowed. They don't mention us or my name at all. But, it's been pretty intense ever since. Facebook seems to consider me a dangerous individual now. If you post a photo of me, and that photo is reported, but they might even have facial recognition technology. I'm not sure how it works, but several people over the past couple of weeks have sent me screenshots of their accounts being banned for posting a photo of me, and Facebook explains that the photo violates their standards, their community standards on dangerous individuals. So I don't know who decided that I was a dangerous individual, or whether it's, you know, whether it comes from state government. And there's every indication that this is the censorship that I'm on the receiving end of. It originates from state government and security agencies. I had a colleague in Victoria Police who confirmed this about 3 years ago, who said that the original United Patriots Front Facebook page was closed down after pressure from the Australian Federal Police and Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. They said that we were a threat to national security, and Facebook, when they hear that, they just comply. But now it's pretty intense. Like when my Instagram account was closed, which I used to just post photos of myself mostly at work or at the gym, that's when I realized that it's pretty intense. Like, they can't even, they can't have, allow me to have any opportunity to normalize myself by mainstream media and state government's standards. I am a evil neo-Nazi, and anything I do that might prove that that's not true is not allowed, including regular photos of me at the pub with friends or just working out at the gym, because that sort of blows holes in their propaganda narrative. But yeah, it's impossible for me to get on Facebook now. Like, if I make a Facebook account, I don't know whether they flag my SIM card, IP address. I don't know what it is. Like, I've tried heaps of different tricks, but in my opinion, if they're going to ban you, if they're going to ban you based on who you are, there's really no point in trying to make an account and hide from them. It's better off just getting off that platform altogether. Actually, I think everyone should just get off Facebook. I don't know why anyone's still on it. Like, it's just a big information gathering program. I mean, everything you post on there, every bit of personal information, every opinion, if it's political, goes down in a police file or is sitting in the database of some intelligence building in your country. I mean, you're really just feeding them information that you don't need to be feeding them. So I'd recommend that no one uses Facebook at all.
Well, that's a big thing. I mean, here tonight we have the most censored man in the history of Australia. So if you haven't liked and shared the stream, please like and share the stream now. Get as many people here as you can. This guy's story needs to be heard. And he is on Telegram. That's actually how I got put in touch with Blair, through Telegram. Now, he does have a Telegram page. It is linked in the description of the show. I will be sharing that on my Telegram and on my Twitter after the show. So please, if you are on Telegram, go and follow Blair. Make sure you're getting updates from him, because one of the ways, obviously, we know the way that social media tries to defeat us, you know, it is the new town square, and they are kicking us off, they're silencing us. And, you know, the fact that there might be facial recognition software that instantly flags people's photos. And also, a really good point here, I want to talk to you a bit about this, because you seem to have a lot harsher sort of, or more repressive laws in Australia, because we get taken down from things. But you're saying here that, you know, you had a personal account where you just, you know, posted gym photos or photos of, you know, yourself out, you know, on a walk with your girlfriend or whatever. And that went as well. Now, the other week, I had a PayPal account and I had a PayPal account because I like playing old computer games. I collect retro Nintendo games. I've got quite a big collection and I trade them on eBay. So sometimes I sell stuff that I don't need anymore. You know, if I get a, if there's a deal come up on something that I've already got and it's in better condition, I'll buy a nice condition box game, put it on the shelf, and the one that's a bit tatty, I'll sell on eBay. It's not a major money earner or anything. It's just my hobby. I'm not really a going out drinking kind of guy. So I like doing stuff around the house. I like tending to my collection, playing a few games. And I thought, you know, having a PayPal, I've never made it public. I've never advertised my PayPal. I wasn't really using it for political purposes. You know, people who wanted to buy my book could write to me and send me a PayPal transaction to buy a book, but it was never publicly advertised or used really for political donations or anything like that. Yet the other day, I got out of the, completely out of the blue. I went to buy something off eBay and it says your PayPal is no longer working. So I went to log in just to see if it was sort of like every few years it asks you to re-verify or double check your bank account. But I got a letter telling me that I was somebody that PayPal wouldn't do business with because I was doing business that they thought was objectionable. I don't know how selling old NES games on eBay is objectionable, but it's obviously because of who I am. And similar things have happened to you guys over there. And I've also heard in Australia that they can actually take your bank account away from you just because of who you are.
Yeah. And I don't think it's got anything to do with our laws. All of this activity might actually be contrary to the law.
Mm-hmm.
It just needs to be argued. The states and the various bureaucrats connected to it can do whatever they want until someone creates a legal precedent and takes them to court. But that costs money. And sometimes when it's average working class people, such as myself, in order to get the money to take people to court or to go to court to answer for some crime, usually we need to raise funds from supporters or from the public. And I think that's largely the reason that my PayPal account and my bank account were shut down, because I wasn't given any specific reason. It just said basically, oh, well, the bank said it was for commercial imperatives and PayPal said your account violates our community policy or something like that, which isn't an answer. It's just an obscure, you know, excuse. But, yeah, it's not – I don't know what the law says in Australia. I'm not a lawyer. But I know that everything is arguable in Australia. Things can go on for quite a while in the courts in this country. Our legal system is based off the same model as England. I've actually heard that we ended up making a fairer legal system than what England had because we wanted to be we sort of wanted to follow the example set by the United States and be a little bit cooler than England, you know, or a little bit freer, as they say. There's nothing you can do about it. Like, until you actually set a precedent by taking these people to court, take representatives from a bank to court, take representatives or journalists from mainstream media editors, whatever, until you sue these people and you put in the time and effort necessary to do that, then they're just going to keep doing it. I mean, why wouldn't they? They're in a position where they can literally just delete their dissent, delete the people they don't like and get away with it. I mean, if you were a communist and you were in a position of power, I'd probably be doing the same thing. And so you've got to understand it from their perspective. These are tyrants. Their whole philosophy of life and the propaganda program that they are disseminating, propagating to people is all lies. So when someone is challenging them, they need to shut that person up, because when your program is based on lies, you can't reason with people. You can't have logical discussions. You have to just scream at them. And if they don't shut up, you have to shut them up. You have to quiet them. You have to censor them. It's the only way that you can protect your regime.
Well, if I could jump in really quickly before Patrick gets onto that mute button, as I know he's gotten hair triggered and the ability to get there. But no, this is something I just quickly say, and I have a question for you, Blair, about the any trends you may have seen in the censorship, the censorial activity that you have undergone. And so just kind of to prep you, get you thinking about that while I make the point here that it doesn't, this is something we've talked about before, ladies and gentlemen. It comes down to anti-whiteism informing decisions that are being made when it comes to laws, policies, rules, et cetera. So Blair, what Blair's pointing out here is that there are not laws in place to enable these people to do these things. Anti-whiteism is informing their ideas to either apply laws or not apply laws. And he's talking about getting a barrister or lawyer, or whatever it's called in Australia, to go to court to sue these people or to try to bring them up on some sort of charges to appeal to the local law enforcement. Again, you're going to see situations here where anti-whiteism is going to be applied to the rules, laws, policies, etc. That's why in the United States, for example, we lose all the time. It doesn't matter how right we are by the letter of the law, we end up losing. It's the reason why in the United States, why they will dilate the law. And we see elsewhere, we saw in the UK, of course, many times this past year, dilate the law to punish those who are heretics to anti-whiteism. And at the same time, they will shrink the law. They will absolutely desiccate and erase the law, policies, rules, whatever it might be, in order to allow those who are anti-white to give them carte blanche to do whatever they want in the world. This is also something else, by the way, just as a parallel thought, that it speaks to the danger of libertarian ideology, that governments are not the main source of oppression for white people today. It's private industry that is the main source for oppression of white people today. So this libertarian lust for an idealization of all things private property, et cetera, is something that if it were instantiated, if government were somehow eradicated, we would end up with a similar scenario, perhaps get there even faster, and that is to white erasure. because you would have these private entities that would be pursuing these anti-white objectives, as we see on places like Facebook. Look at all of these places that Blair has been censored from again and again and again. Look at me. Blair's taken a little bit of a different track than I have, where I have said everywhere the anti-white censor me, I'll get on two more platforms. I've kept that promise. I've gotten back onto many of these platforms. I can't tell you the number of times I've been censored off of PayPal as a consequence. But these are not government entities. In fact, it's a government entity that allows Jared Taylor to have his conferences down in Tennessee. So private entities such as hotels and the like have been undermining us for two decades. So what I want to ask here of Blair, I've actually got quite a few questions for you, brother, and what you've had to deal with. I'll ask two of them right now to you because they kind of go together. One is this. What kind of, have you noticed any trends when it comes to censoring you? Have you noticed that you get on a platform and you have to do very little on the platform and then you're censored? Or do you have to begin to engage others and then they find and identify you? Or is it a number of pictures or videos or something like that that they finally find and then censor you? When you are on a payment processor, do you have to begin taking in donations before you're censored? Is it a certain amount of days or certain number of donations? And along with that, if you can answer this question, how do you, and this is something that we pride ourselves on here with Mark and Patrick and all the work that we do in service to white well-being, is that we always have a robust response, a healthy response. When they censor us, it doesn't get us down. So how does it land on you emotionally when they censor you? You obviously seem to be more emboldened even though they censor again and again. So if you could talk to that, because a lot of folks out there listening right now live and who will be listening soon are going to be looking at Blair and they're going to be saying, how does this land on Blair? How should it land on me if I'm censored? How should I feel about our people being censored? So both of those questions, please, sir.
First of all, it really depends, I think, on the staff member in question on Facebook who happens upon me at the time. Your censorship really depends on the whim of whoever it is that's reviewing any report, whatever staff member is reviewing the report, Facebook staff, I think, because sometimes I'm banned straight away before I even post anything, like really within an hour of making a new account. And then other times I can survive for 3 months and get another 10 or 20,000 followers and then they'll find some obscure reason to ban me. I've never been banned for a good reason, I don't think. I've never, been deliberately over the top or too antagonistic or engaged in an argument with someone where I've vilified them. I just don't do that as a general rule. I think it's a bit of a distraction from the purpose for using the platform in the first place. How does it affect me emotionally? Ugh, it doesn't really. I think I was compelled to get involved in politics, obviously, because I love my country and my heritage. But it's also for psychological reasons. Since I was young, I've always been a bit of a troublemaker. You know, when I see authority or someone purporting to be in a position of authority over me, my immediate response is always, "Oh, you're in charge of me, are you? Well, show me why." You know, so someone who rocks the boat just instinctively. And so that, in conjunction with what I saw happening to my country, was the main motivating factor for me. And emotionally, I can't answer that because I don't feel that I have been emotionally affected. If anything, I was relieved. I never wanted to be a leader of some movement. It just happened. And then everyone was looking to me suddenly because I was the only one delivering any sort of effective message to people at the time. And I fell into this position in the same way. I sometimes felt a little bit like you could Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games. I was just a reluctant leader for a while. And when I was censored, it was almost a bit of a relief for me. I was like, well, I don't have to do that anymore. That's actually pretty cool. But then you feel obliged because so many people are counting on you, so many people believed in you, and you inspired and woke a lot of people up. Well, that's what I did through my political activity. And so I've felt called back into it now to participate again, and I believe that I'll be building something pretty big at the start of next year. Now that I'm free of court and all the legal charges, I'm basically free to dedicate my time to rebuilding the movement that I created 3 years ago.
Well, I'll jump in for a second. First of all, you know, it was interesting. You said that Facebook says that they remove your account because of community standards. And community standards, I guess we're so used to hearing that, but it's actually very Orwellian because they're not community standards. I'm sure that the community that you live in, that your values are, you know, your traditional values. So what really do they mean by community standards? And indeed, what do they mean by community? Jason knows that in America, you've got a Black community and you've got a Hispanic community and an Asian community. But I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about a white community. We're not allowed to have community. So community doesn't mean what it used to mean. It just means basically a group of non-whites. And, you know, I'm not trying to be incendiary about this. It's just that's what it means. Now, I was in Australia. I've been there a couple of times, and I was there a few years ago. I remember walking around Sydney, Brisbane, and it's like, Daddy, where are the white people? There really weren't. There weren't, you know, you could walk around big areas and you wouldn't see very many white people. There a lot of Asians. In some places you go, a lot of Muslims. And I went to Alice Springs. Alice Springs, going into one of the big stores there where people shop, a supermarket, and there were security guards. And the security guards were from South Sudan. Are they doing the jobs that Australians aren't capable of doing? You know, why do there have to be a bunch of South Sudanese in Alice Springs working as security guards? So it's just all very bizarre. And somehow community standards prevent you from questioning it. It's just all so bizarre. And, you know, of course, also Jason brought up the issue of, are we being censored by the government? Are we being censored by business? And, you know, at some point, like we know in the old fashioned Soviet style systems, you had government controlled business. In our system, maybe you have business controlled government. Instead of a government run media, maybe you've got a media run government to an extent. You have an establishment, and the establishment is rooted in both business and in the private sector. And sometimes it's hard to see where one begins and one ends. They're certainly both hostile to us. We've got, in the United States, you've got this ongoing coup d'etat. I guess to use this opportunity for a question, my question is, in Australia, really, to what extent have people drunk the Kool-Aid? To what extent are your views really shared by many people, even if they're afraid to say it out loud? What do you think? To what extent are your views more mainstream than one would think?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't flatter the Marxists of the United States with the term coup d'etat. I wouldn't describe what they're doing as a coup d'etat. Problem with psych warfare is it's just, it gives the opportunity to people who are afraid of fighting to use any and other means other than fighting to worm their way into positions of authority. And as a result, in authority, you end up with nothing but cowards and liars. Also, community standards. Well, what are community standards? If you're a white person, you're basically, your existence goes against multicultural community standards. And this is something a lot of people don't understand about Australia, and I think a lot of Australians don't understand it about their own country too. Multiculturalism and the slogan, diversity is our greatest strength, these aren't just slogans, they are the law. Since 1994 in Australia, through the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act, multiculturalism, Australia being a multicultural and diverse society, has been in legislation and it's been enacted since then. And specifically in that legislation, it states that the purpose of the legislation is not so much legal, but social and for educational purposes. And it goes on to give examples that steps of how, what sort of steps need to be taken in order to further educate the community in the direction of multiculturalism and diversity. So the purpose of this law since the beginning, since it was passed, and I don't know whether the parliamentarians who passed this law were on the payroll of some hidden hand or some special interest group, or whether they just like pretended that it was a nice thing. They just took it at face value and said, oh, yeah, this sounds nice, let's pass it. You know, like, but the examples about how this law is to be enacted is through education. And what is education? It's not just school. I mean, television programs, even radio shows, are a form of adult education. They're a form of education that takes place on a daily basis, you know, propagation system for the average person. But, the average person in Australia does not like multiculturalism, the average white working class Australian. They're actually sick of hearing the word, which is why the word multiculturalism is not used anymore. Now we hear diversity. And well, for a while we were hearing refugees. That was the big thing, refugees welcome. But that only lasted a few years because, mostly thanks to social media and Facebook, there was a extreme backlash from the working Australian public about the refugee policies that were basically being forced onto the country by political bureaucrats and members of the media class. So now it's all about diversity. Actually, it's not really about anything anymore. They don't really talk about multiculturalism or the mass migration system anymore. Now, if anyone who is talking about it basically gets censored or fired from their position in mainstream media. It's a non-issue now. It's treated like it's a non-issue, although Australia, in terms of infrastructure and space, is literally a bursting point as a result of mass immigration. But the point is that in Australia, multiculturalism is not just a political slogan. It's the law, and it has been since 1944. Think of it as a speed limit, right? I've said this once before. You can drive down a street that might be 60 kilometres per hour speed limit. Like, you can disagree with it all you want. You could say, I don't agree with this speed limit. But if you don't do it, like, you're breaking the law. So if you take steps to prevent multiculturalism from happening in some way, even by speech, you could essentially be breaking the law in Australia. And that's the situation that Australian workers are currently in, and most of them don't even know it. So as I said before, all of the censorship against me and people like me in my country, I didn't say that it wasn't legal. I said it might not necessarily be legal, but based on the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act, which legislates multiculturalism into the law, it may technically be illegal to publicly criticize it, because that may in the minds of everyday people be discouraging them from believing in the beautiful, noble society of diverse equality. But as I said, the average Australian person is against these policies. They don't like it. They see the transformation taking place in Australia, and they are against it. Average working people on job sites every day are talking about it. They recognise it as a destructive thing. They don't necessarily see it as a deliberate destructive effort. Many people believe that it is just a mistake on the part of the government, that they mistakenly took on this multicultural policy because they thought it was going to be a really beautiful experiment, and it's just gone horribly wrong, you know, so it's just a mistake. The possibility that it's being done to their country deliberately for a destructive purpose is often a little bit too much for regular people. They get a little bit afraid and they refuse to believe that they've been lied to on that scale. But the point is, most Australian people, most working Australian people don't like it. They don't like the political class, they don't like the media class, and they will voice quite often their disgust in members of government and media elite on job sites.
Well, there's something I really want to ask you. It was something that Patrick said that sort of triggered me into wanting to ask this question. Patrick said that when he went to Australia, he saw a huge number of non-whites, and I know that white people aren't indigenous to Australia, but white people did make Australia what it is today. Australia wouldn't be the first world country it is without European settlers. Now, it's a really interesting thing because when Patrick said that, many people in the UK would be really puzzled by this, because here in the UK, there's this sort of conservative mantra that Australia has the best immigration system in the whole world. And we keep hearing from like the Daily Mail and the Conservative Party here in the UK, oh, we don't need limits on immigration. We're going to have an Australian style points based system where, you know, every immigrant is vetted. And every immigrant is apportioned these points, and they need so many points to go in. But from what Patrick's saying, it doesn't sound like the points-based system is actually doing anything for Australians. In fact, it sounds as if Australians are facing exactly the same problems of replacement and displacement as Europeans are here in Europe and in North America. Can you comment a bit on this, as I said, because lots of our viewers will have heard this from the Conservative Party. It's actually an election pledge at the moment from Boris Johnson, who's the leader of the Conservative Party, that he's going to bring in, he's finally going to sort out the immigration problem with an Australian points-based system. Is that simply just more hot air and rubbish?
Well, first of all, there wouldn't be Australia as a nation or a nation state without European colonials. Before the arrival of the first British fleet, Australia was known by sailors as Terra Nullius, which I think means unknown southern land in Latin, or Terra Nullius Australis or something like that. But that's why I find it amusing that the true indigenous people to Australia, the Aboriginals, consider themselves the first Australians. Mostly because they hadn't actually named the country that they lived on. They'd only named things on it. They hadn't mapped it. Or they didn't even have any understanding of where they lived as being an island. But the second part to your question, I'm sorry, was what? It's early in the morning.
Yes, I know, sorry. For people who don't appreciate this, Blair had to get up at 5:30 a.m. to come on. So it is very early for him. No, I was saying that, here in the UK, the Australian points-based immigration system is kind of like trumpeted as the greatest immigration system the world's ever known. And currently, Boris Johnson's going around telling everyone that, you know, anyone who's got concerns over immigration, we don't even need limits on immigration, because once we have this Australian points-based system, everything's going to be sorted. But obviously, from what Patrick's saying, you're facing exactly the same problems as we are. And I just want somebody from Australia to explain to sort of our wider audience how the points-based system is just as rubbish as sort of every other system.
Yeah, the points-based system, for whoever doesn't know, in Australia is a system through which any new arrival into the country earns a certain point of status and must remain above a certain point threshold. I think it's 65 or 70 in order to legally stay in Australia. The way you earn points as a newly arrived immigrant is through maintaining a job, paying your tax, obeying the law, etc. However, what a lot of people don't realize is the point system is only put in place for legal skilled immigrants. It's not put in place for refugees or people that come into the country claiming to be seeking refuge from some poverty or war-stricken circumstance. Whether or not it's true is another thing. Australia is actually, it takes something of a strong standpoint on immigration. When newly arrived immigrants who can't prove who they are, or can't prove their work history, try to come into Australia, they're sent offshore to a detention centre. And this is something that the noble humanitarian leftists are always disgusted by in Australia. They want to do everything they can to get these unknown people into the country as fast as possible, because that basically proves what nice people they are, at least to one another. But I can't comment too much more on the point system. I only know that it's only truly enforced probably on European and maybe Indian immigrants as well. There are a lot of Indian immigrants coming into Australia because there's so much new development. There's tens of thousands, I would say even hundreds of thousands of cheap new homes being built inland in former swampland in Australia. so close to each other, they're virtually touching. Mm. And you have to ask yourself, if Australian birth rates are so low, why Australian birth rates? Why would developers be buying up all this land and building hundreds of thousands of new homes? Who's going to buy those homes if Australians aren't having children? The answer is simple. Moderately wealthy immigrants are encouraged through various ambassadors that work for the developers to come into the country and buy these homes, get in debt, and basically it's like little India inland from where I live. Mm-hmm. And various areas like that where all the new developments are taking place. It's just a huge, for lack of a better term, clusterfuck of Indians and Pakistanis mostly. I'd say the Africans, they fall into a different category. Most of the South Sudanese immigrants are here on refugee status, or they are the children of immigrants that came here on refugee status.
Does Jason or Patrick have any follow-up questions to this? Jason, you are muted.
I am unmuted. Usually I'm unmuted just in case. But yeah, I definitely do. The immigration issue, we were talking a moment ago, I could tie it back to the conversation or the topic that we were saying a moment ago, which is this, the white people, you said our people in Australia, of course, the only real Australians are white people, because you have to have the biosphere to create Australia inside of you to be able to have an Australia or sustain an Australia. So the real Australians there, the white people in Australia, you were talking about how they think it's some sort of accident that things are getting worse. So you have these border crossers coming in, doctors, lawyers, judges, and that are engineers coming into Australia. And clearly neighborhoods are going to be changing. Now, one of the things that we think is very important is not just the fact when the neighborhood becomes more criminal, but also when the non-white peoples attain what we refer to as numerical courage, and they begin projecting their biospirit, their different world view, their different likes and dislikes, norms, onto their environments around them, which makes it an environment very different from the environment that you all create and are used to seeing. So am I right in hearing that many or most or a good percentage of Australians are of the perception that multiracialism is damaging the country, is damaging what they hold dear? And yet you're saying here, and this is the, I think, important point for all of us to think about, is that they're still projecting who and what they are onto those who are making this happen. And that's why they think it's an accident, because they themselves would never change an area for an entire people, would never change an entire country for an entire people. And if this is the case, then if the perception is that multiracialism is bad, is the human soil, the human capital there of our people, is it becoming increasingly rich, increasingly ripe for messages like you have to bring to them about our well-being vis-a-vis multiracialism and bringing in hordes and hordes of doctors, lawyers, judges, and astronauts?
Yeah, like I said, for regular people, the possibility that there is actually an ethnic genocide campaign taking place in their country and they are scheduled for extermination and replacement by a cheaper, easier to lie to, easier to manage workforce of smaller capacity for thought, it's just too much for them. They can't process that possibility. Instead, they prefer to repeat the slogan that multiculturalism has failed. But I always say to them, it hasn't failed. It's done exactly what it was supposed to do. I mean, what do you think it was supposed to do? Do you think all of these big, rich corporate bureaucrats and politicians and mass media moguls truly wanted to create a multicultural society of harmony? Like, do you think that's what these rich and powerful people had in mind when they legislated that policy in your country? Of course not. You're scheduled for replacement, ethnic replacement. Why? Well, because you demand too much freedom, too many rights, you think too much. Just look at examples of communism all around the world, in Eastern Europe and in Russia. Mm. Whenever communism is opposed on white people, they don't tolerate it. They eventually rise up against it and it collapses within one or two generations. The only people who seem to tolerate it are the Asians, like the Chinese can put up with it. And, obviously India tolerated tyrannical rule for a long time without doing anything about it. And so, you know, what a perfect system for a small network of corporate tyrants or Marxists, whatever we want to call these people, we know who they are, to have only two classes, themselves and then a mass mongrel mixed class of people too stupid and too divided to ever form any sort of resistance against them. And that's what multiculturalism was about from the start. It wasn't about harmony and equality. These are feel-good slogans. There's a saying, it's a Shakespearean saying that, oh, what a good exterior deception have, something like that. It's like that a beautiful apple that seems in great condition, it can still be rotten in the core. And this is what they've done. They've created this this never-ending repetitive network of slogans about how humane and how good-natured and good in, how good their intent is. But really, from the beginning, like, their intent has been power, control through genocide. It's really that simple. And anybody who thinks that's not possible hasn't been paying attention and doesn't understand history. Like I said, for average-minded people, it's not really possible to process deceptions of that magnitude, because regular people don't lie like that. Regular people tell lies such as, hey, boss, I'm sick, I can't come to work today. They tell small lies. They don't plan the genocide of a whole people because they want a more manageable workforce. That's not an average person lie, and so average people find it hard to process that that's happening. They find it hard to believe that that many people could be in on it and that it's been going on for that long. But the problem is, it is happening. That many people are in on it, consciously or unconsciously. They're being paid good money to be in on it, and it's been happening to you for quite some time.
Okay. So there's a couple issues I want to address. One is, you know, the issue of white people in Australia. And we had, if you turn the clock back a few centuries, there were some parts of the globe that had hunter-gatherers, had, you know, Stone Age hunter-gatherer societies, whatever, cultures. The only place where you still have, where one has been preserved, there's a little island in the Andaman Sea, and they're left more or less unmolested. Nowhere else. And it doesn't matter, you know, all these Stone Age hunter-gatherer societies were overrun typically by whoever was closest. The Pygmies and the Bushmen were overrun by Bantus, by Africans, you know, Black Africans. So it's happened everywhere. And the idea that the great continent of Australia would remain the domain of hunter-gatherers, there was no way that was going to happen. And now it so happened that rather than being nearby Southeast Asians or Chinese, who sooner or later would have stumbled across Australia, would have happened sooner or later. The Europeans, the British, got there first, Captain Cook, and they set up a society there. If they hadn't done that in the late 1700s, probably by the early 1800s, Chinese or maybe Vietnamese would have come across it, probably the Chinese, because they were out in the Indian Ocean. And if you look at the fate of minorities in China, you know, Tibetans or Uyghurs or Mongolians or Manchurians, they've been completely overwhelmed demographically. And I'm not trying to whip up anti-Chinese sentiment or anything, but the fact of the matter is they were completely overwhelmed. And we're not talking about hunter-gatherer societies here. We're talking about literate societies. And yet they were overwhelmed, completely marginalized. And it's not as if Europeans have always been benevolent rulers wherever they go. At the end of the day, made much more provisions for a continuation of an Aboriginal race and an Aboriginal society than any other group would have, than the Chinese or Indians or Southeast Asians would have. So I don't think there's any cause for guilt about a white country being set up in Australia. And, you know, the Aborigines, I don't mean to demean them in any way. And when I was in Dream World on the Gold Coast near Brisbane a few years back, I had a very nice conversation with an Aboriginal gentleman there who was sweeping the grounds with a broom, but he was also a musician and he was somebody who had traveled around. And so it's not to be demeaning, but the idea that you can expect the same from Aborigines as you could from either white people or Asian people or other groups. You can't expect them to live the same way. You can't expect them to sit in a classroom for 8 hours at a time and study and get degrees, because the genes that make that tolerable were of absolutely no benefit to them prior to their contact with Europeans. And so they just don't have that capacity.
You can't encourage qualities to the surface in a people which were never in them in the first place. And that's the point you're making.
And I'm not trying to be demeaning. I'm sure there's a lot of things that they can do. I mean, I know I went outside Alice Springs. I can't remember the place I went to. And some of the things that men would do, they might track feral horses, and they might track the feral horses for a few days and get one and be able to sell it. And I don't know how many people could do that, but it's a skill that's actually not particularly valuable in a modern society. But it's the type of thing that would have been valuable to them at the time. So it's not to be demeaning, but it's just that there are differences. And at least the British who set up the modern Australian state at the end of the day, tried to make a lot of provisions for these people. And I doubt the Chinese would have done the same. And I'm not trying to be mean to the Chinese either, but I doubt they would have done the same. And I think Blair makes a really good point about communism. The American political scientist who was very influential in the mid-20th century after the World War II, George Kennan, is the father of the policy of containment. Containment, a lot of people think of containment as, you don't let the Soviet Union expand its influence so that, ultimately we can defeat them. The whole idea, George Kennan's concept of containment was sooner or later, the Russian people they're too Russian to stay communist. The Russian people aren't going to accept that system forever. And so let's just wait it out. The Russian people will sort it out on their own. That was actually his concept. And Blair seems to have the same understanding that the European people, it's that type of system, which was very foreign. It wasn't, it's a kind of a tribal ideology, and we know which tribe it was imposed on them. Well, last thing I want to say, we often talk about a more manageable workforce, but really at the end of the day, I think the replacement, the ethnic replacement, dispossession and replacement, it's easier to talk about, in business terms, they want a more manageable workforce. It's a little bit more than just the workforce. They want a more manageable population, a controllable population, and clearly a population where you have a potential of ethnic-based nationalism that would have the strength to overthrow this, this small tribal elite that dominates our societies. That's really what they want to prevent. So not just manageable workforce, but manageable population. That's not really a question, but
That's definitely not a question, but I have a question. I can follow up with a quick question before we move on to the viewer questions for the panel and for Blair. Having you on has been really great tonight, and we've talked about a range of different things. But when I first saw you and you first appeared on social networks, and I saw you on Facebook when you were on Facebook, you sort of got involved through the sort of anti-Islam movement, and that's what you were known for. But you've really gone on this incredible political journey, and now you've, you know, seen the bigger picture. You're talking about the same issues as us. You're talking about issues of white genocide, of people being bred out in the countries of their forefathers or the countries their forefathers created. How has that affected you going on that political journey? And have you found it's made you more friends, or have you found that some people have dumped you and now won't work with you because you now see and talk about the bigger picture?
It would be a mistake to think that I've developed this much more intricate or a much deeper understanding as I progressed through politics. I knew everything I know now 5 years ago. I just was pragmatic about my political approach, or even expedient, you might say, in choosing to alert the population about the one small aspects of a greater problem in order to get their attention so I could educate them more on the subject. The one small aspect that I chose to focus on in the beginning was Islamic immigration, because that's what was getting people's hearts beating. But then I went on to explain psychological warfare and the subversion that I saw was one of the root causes behind the threat that Australia and the whole West and the world faces right now. But really what I think is important to discuss is not so much the distant past but the immediate past and how this has happened to our countries. If we understand how we've arrived at this point, then we can understand what we have to do to get out of this situation and also to prevent it from happening in the first place. And I wanted to do a demonstration on that when I get back onto either Telegram or BitChute. And basically it's the result of weakness in state security, in our own state security agencies that we set up in the beginning, and the inability to understand deception and manipulation of words and terms. The concept of freedom and democracy basically made our security intelligence organizations believe that people coming into this country with destructive and foreign concepts, ideologies, was also part of freedom. You know, I wanted to refer to Yuri Bezmenov and his demonstration, the former KGB agent from the Soviet Union, when he says that in order for a country to be targeted by psychological warfare and subversion, it needs to be receptive, and the most receptive countries in the world to psych warfare are democracies, because they're obsessed with freedom. And so when you have this idea of total freedom all the time, then your enemy sees an opportunity there to come into your country, fund whoever they want, buy whoever they want, and to start a slow process of transformation in your country for their own gains. But yeah, it's been good coming on. So I'm not sure what we go on to now, what the next part of the show is.
All right, it's questions for you from the audience. We have Entropy, which is the free speech alternative to Super Chat, and that allows people to send us donations. It also allows people to ask questions, and the best questions are voted up. So we now have an hour of questions and answers from the audience. And I'll start with the Super Chats. Gordon Miller gave us $10 and said, great job, lads. Thank you very much. F22 Daniel gave $3 and said, Blair, how is the African youth crime in Melbourne getting better or worse? And also, what was the follow-up after the gay marriage referendum? And is the black population in Footscray increasing or not? So there's three questions. Black youth crime in Melbourne, what was the follow-up after the gay marriage referendum? And what is the black population in Footscray like?
The African youth crime crisis in Melbourne was something that was reported on sometimes about a year ago, or just before a year ago, about a year and a half ago. Because it was so rampant, it was impossible for mainstream media journalists to ignore it, especially after a man in the northern suburbs was murdered, a white Australian man was murdered by Africans wielding machetes on the street. Carjackings, jewelry store robberies, even McDonald's restaurants being exploited. It was so rampant that it was reported on. For the last 12 months, ever since I hosted a rally in St Kilda that was very successful despite enormous censorship efforts on the part of Facebook and the state government, and the mainstream media journalists saying that I was essentially a domestic terrorist right before the rally to try to discourage people to go. It was still very successful, and the one of the main motivators, one of the main reasons I hosted that rally was to address the root cause of this crime crisis, which was our immigration policy, which was, you know, ultimately led back into government bureaucracy and media corruption. But since that rally, I haven't heard a single report about the crime crisis. I haven't seen anything in the media about any more carjackings or robberies or murders. Or there's been one thing, I think, in St Kilda, but they don't talk about the ethnicity of offenders anymore, and they don't release photos or video footage and say, if you've seen these people, contact police, as if you can tell them apart anyway. But so I think it's interesting that there's been a blanket ban on reporting on that crime crisis in Australia now. So even though you don't hear about it anymore, it probably still is getting progressively worse. I actually heard in some of the more wealthy suburbs, the young Africans are targeting people there because they all have nicer cars, and a lot of them just generally offer up a lot less resistance. The second question, what was the second question?
What was the follow-up from people after the gay marriage referendum?
Oh, yeah. Well, the gay marriage referendum in Australia, it was almost an enormous and very rushed brainwashing process by the government and media class. Some Labor Party bureaucrat had a connection with Telstra of some sort, and he used that connection to have Telstra send out texts to everybody telling them to vote yes on gay marriage. I myself got a text. Every government office that you can see in any town, city, suburb was covered in rainbow stickers telling people to vote yes. Radio programs were telling people to vote yes. The receipts, your docket from the local supermarkets told you at the bottom to vote yes. It was everywhere. It was an enormous effort in terms of propaganda. And what's been the result? As far as I'm aware, nothing. It was not actually a referendum. It was a postal vote. And so it holds no legal power. It can be used in the courts as an argument for why it should be legalized, but because it was not a compulsory vote, it doesn't hold any actual power in Australia. It's only an example or an exemplary case. As far as I'm aware, nothing has happened. I could imagine that these government bureaucrats are drawing up some sort of legislation that they're trying to get passed in the courts, but that always takes some time. I know that they're being opposed by various Christian lobby groups, especially because they're trying to tell priests and pastors, Christian pastors, that they can't, that they must marry gay people, and that if they refuse, they can go to jail. And that's really stirring the Christians up, as you can imagine. And the last question?
That was about the black population in Footscray. Is it increasing or not?
I don't know about Footscray. I'm in the southeastern suburbs, and I don't go to Footscray very much, so I couldn't comment on that. Couldn't imagine it's getting any smaller, though.
No. Well, thank you for the answer to that. The next question is from Serena JB. She sent $5. Thank you very much. And she asked, is Australia suffering from the same group of people we dare not name as we are suffering in the rest of the West?
Yes. And Julia Gillard, before failing to even finish her term as a prime minister, signed the Global Anti-Semitism Declaration, which pretty much makes it illegal to talk about that. So that is your answer.
Well, thank you for that. Steve Ben Bob gave $3 and said, Blair, is the LGBTQ agenda being taught to school kids in Australia like it is being taught to kids in Western Europe and the United States?
Yes, it is. It's very aggressive propaganda at a public school level. Most primary schools now have at least one transgender child, and that's not an exaggeration. That's the truth. This is actually stirring the Christians up as well, which is a good thing, I think. It's about time the Christians got involved in social political process. For the longest time, Christians have been singing feel-good songs and talking of the Spirit on their Sunday sessions, And of course, the state government and media powers are happy to allow them to do that without criticizing them, without attacking them directly too much, because they're not being effective so long as they're doing that. But now they're finally starting to get their petitions going, but they'll discover in time that in the current political state of things, that the petition is like bringing a feather to a knife fight. So they're going to need to get more aggressive if they're going to affect change and protect children from this gender distorting propaganda, whatever you want to call it. But it is extremely aggressive in this country, and the people behind it are all, I think they're all very sick people. I know several of them, not personally, but I know who they are, and I've looked into them a little bit. They are all either homosexuals or transgender themselves. Most of them were interfered with when they were young. And basically they're just trying to, as any sickness does, spread itself to make itself feel more normal, I suppose.
Okay, thank you for that. Mark Hooper sent $25. Thank you very much. And he asked, how is Fraser Anning doing?
I don't know. The problem with Australian politics, if you're going to form a parliamentary party or if you're going to get into party politics, it's very traditional. And tradition is a big pillar of power. People only vote for parties they're familiar with. So if you're going to start a new party and getting voted for or getting any sort of representation in parliament on the first go is virtually unheard of. That's why even though most Australians do not like the major parties, they'll still vote for the lesser evil of what they think is among them, meaning like they'll choose the one they think is not as bad as the other, and they'll still vote for the major parties because it's traditional to vote for the major parties. Fraser Anning started a new party, and it would be very naive to think that just because he didn't get elected immediately after starting a new party or didn't end up with any sort of seat or even lost his seat, that that'll be the end of him. The mainstream media journalists and leftists, as we call them, they like to pretend there's a victory where there's really no victories for them. And I think that's the situation with Fraser Anning. I don't know what's going on with him. I haven't been following it, but I wouldn't rule him out just yet. I'd say that he's probably got a few more miles on him before he carks it, but we'll see how he goes.
Excellent. Yeah, he's one of those people that people know over here because he seemed to be sort of quite a strong anti-immigration voice. Naughty gave $10 and he said, you just deserve it, fellas. Thank you. Jeff Mann gave $5 and said, the bonds a government sells in order to borrow are directly proportioned in accordance with population. Every extra immigrant is extra credit. Tipsy McStagger gave $14 and said, I live in Canberra and most people in this city have no clue as to what's going on. It seems to me that the ACT doesn't get the same percentage coming in to try and hide it from the working class. What's your take on that?
If that was meaning the Australian Capital Territory doesn't get as much immigration, from what I've seen, that's true. I've only been to Canberra 3 times in the last few years, only for political activity. I actually had never travelled outside or very far outside my hometown until I got involved in politics, and now I've been to every major city in the country and smaller inland cities too. I've travelled the country in the last 4 years. So I've seen it all firsthand. ACT is a strategically built location based on old British strategy or land strategy. There's only one way in and out, and it's basically Parliament House surrounded by a big series of mountains acting as a big, almost impenetrable by ground blockade. And like I said, there's only one entry in and out of that place, and that's where Parliament House is in the Australian Capital Territory. So, from what I've seen, definitely not as much immigration around there. It's actually like ghost town. You go there and the streets are huge. And there's mostly, but I know that there's a great class divide as well. I mean, there's Parliament House up on the hill, as you can imagine, like in an old British medieval situation. And then down across the moat, there's just the slums where all these regular workers live. And That's what ACT is like, in from my understanding.
Okay, we have another super chat from the Thin Red Line. He gave $10 and said, great show, guys. And that's the end of the super chats. But if you want to make a donation or contribution, you can do so via Entropy. The link is in the chat now. It is also in the description of the show. It's on Telegram and on Twitter. It is the only way to contribute to the show. And contributions are all gratefully received and all read out. But we do also have the Entropy questions. Anglo to the core. This is the top voted question of today. Anglo to the core asked, what are Blair's thoughts on Sir Oswald Mosley?
British Union of Fascists, huh? I haven't done a great deal of research on Mosley. I know who he is, and I've read some of one of his books. Judged on results, I don't know if he was terribly effective. I don't know if that's what the British people needed at the time. My thoughts about him, it's hard to answer because I don't really have any. I would have to research him more. But as I said, like I judge everything or every political effort made on the behalf of an individual or a group based on its results. And in terms of generating popularity, he produced visibly great results. But, you know, the same could be said for, you know, the he who shall not be named. He was great at being popular, and he was great at winning for a short period of time, but in the end he didn't win. And therefore there's a problem with that regime, there's a problem with that ideology, there's a problem with that system. I could probably say the same for Oswald Mosley. Like, you know, it's easy to get popular. I'm not being arrogant when I say that. If anybody with consistency and who's not totally retarded can get popular. It's what you do with that popularity and the result that you produce that I think defines you.
Okay, the next question. Blair, do you find many expat POMs getting involved in Aussie nationalism?
Yeah, heaps of them. Like, a lot of old street fighters, actually. There's a lot of people with the English accent in Australia still. I think most of Adelaide, which is a city in Australia, most people there to us sound like they're from England. They still have the accent mostly, or to some degree. To you guys, they probably wouldn't sound that way. But yeah, there's definitely, I don't know what's expat mean? What's that? Sorry, I'm not.
That's British expatriates. People from Britain often relocate to Australia, and he's asking, are many of the, do you get a lot of, British expatriates who are now living in Australia interested in Australian nationalism?
Well, we're all British expats in a way. But recent arrivals, yeah, sure. Like, there's a fair few that have been involved in our social club. So, yeah, definitely.
I think you've already answered this question, but Marky Mark Ali asked, is Blair woke to the JQ?
What do you think?
Yeah, you've already answered that one. So the thin red line asked, are there any prospects of a nationalist party in Australia? Now, with this one, can I also sort of bundle in another couple of questions? Firstly, are you starting anything? Will you be ever doing anything again with the United Patriots Front? And also, there's a lady in Australia who was running. Was it... I can't remember the name of it, but she's a red-haired lady in Australia. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Is there a prospect of getting a nationalist party off the ground? What's Pauline Hanson up to? Was it One Nation, her party?
I wouldn't say that Pauline Hanson is a nationalist. I think the likelihood or the possibility of a nationalist political party gaining power rises in proportion with the possibility of the communists gaining power. I think in order for nationalism to be in a position of power during times of peace, you might say, it really just depends on the way things are conveyed, the way the party's programs conveyed and what slogans they use. But I think if you're talking about strict proper nationalism, the possibility that a party could arise or will arise is basically, as I said, rises at the same time the possibility of communists getting elected does. There is a great possibility. I don't know if I'll be the one to start a party. I'm not a party politician. I despise that kind of activity. I actually don't like politics. I hate politics. I just enjoy educating people, and I enjoy talking about the truth and challenging people who claim to be in positions of authority, because most people these days who are in positions of authority are liars and cowards. So that's where my position. I hope that a popular nationalist party does come together. If no one else is doing it, yeah, sure, like maybe it'll be me, but like I said, I would prefer not to get involved in party politics. It's just not really suited to my personality.
Again, based on that then, with that not being suited to your personality, do you see you ever, say you built up your Telegram, you built up alternative networks to contact people. It'd be great to see you on BitChute or streaming on DLive or other sort of outsider platforms. Would there be the potential for you to get a street movement up and running again? Because you see all the problems that Australia is facing. There must be a lot of people who want to see you return and start holding your rallies again.
Yeah. And whether or not I'm going to form another street movement, I've yet to consider that question. What I enjoyed doing the most from the beginning was talking plainly about the problems in Australia, but also how these problems arise and what we can do to combat them and prevent them from happening to us again in the future. So I liked to give demonstrations, and that was what I enjoyed. That's what I enjoyed doing the most, as I said. So the street movement thing really was just the result of my own impulsivity and my youth at the time. I don't know. It definitely assisted in generating or building up my own popularity. I don't think that was the purpose in mind I had at the time. I think I was reacting mostly out of impulse and disgust and moral indignation at the system that claims to be our government, also media class. But I would like to at least begin by just talking plainly about the situation in Australia and maybe helping people to understand things better so that they can communicate. But I think what's most important is to convey everything while keeping in mind that you are conveying messages to just regular people, and arming people with correct responses to questions and helping them to, in conversation with each other, to make sense and to talk about things in a way that other people will understand them easily as well. Like a tree network, you could imagine. You begin with the seed, you being the seed, and then you spread. And so long as your message is simple, easy to understand, articulate, then it's going to spread itself. Words are the most portable of all materials, and so that's where I would like to begin again.
Yeah, no, I want to make this point quite clear. I mean, here in the UK, sort of street movements and street politics don't really work that well. They're a bit of a dead end. But in Australia, you seem to have a very different culture to what we have here in the UK. For example, it's similar to Poland. In Poland, they have massive street demonstrations, which are actually quite politically productive and lead somewhere. Whereas here, it's very different. I just wanted to make that clear for my audience, because a lot of the street demonstrations that have taken place here in the UK have just ended in absolute abject disaster and have generally led to mass arrests and little else. I'm just going to delete that question. Right, Adam asked, and this is for the whole group, what are your thoughts on Friday's terror attack? I'll start with you, Blair. Have you heard of that, the terror attack that took place in London?
You'll have to fill me in. I literally haven't.
I'll give everyone the brief lowdown. Convicted terrorist named Usman Khan. He was convicted in 2012 of preparing serious acts of terrorism, including plans to fund overseas terrorists, start an overseas terrorist training camp. He was his sentence was an indeterminate sentence, which was 16 years. And after 8 years, he had to go before a parole board, at which point he had to prove that he changed, he was reformed. This was quashed on appeal, and he was allowed a determinate sentence, meaning he was instantly allowed out at the 8-year period. Whilst in prison, he was helped by a group called Learning Together, and two young people, Saskia Jones and Jack Merritt, were involved with the Learning Together group. Now, this group, social justice warrior group, campaigns for serious offenders, criminals, terrorists to be released early, especially if they're of a certain ethnicity. They got him a computer, even though he wasn't allowed one. They got him a special computer which didn't breach his license. They got him a special pass allowing him to come to London, because he was banned from going to London because that was where he was planning most of his terrorist attacks. He turned up in London for this Learning Together group. They were holding him up as their poster boy, their hero of the day, because he'd completely reformed and he was a good boy now and certainly wasn't going to do anything bad. Then he pulled out two knives, started stabbing people, killed two of the Learning Together organisers, fled to London Bridge, where he started attacking other people, was restrained by passers-by before being shot dead by armed police because he was wearing a fake suicide vest. And this was all followed up by Jack Merritt, one of the Learning Together organisers, who was killed by him. His father said, you know, this is the last thing we want, is people like him being given harsher sentences just because my son's dead. And then Sadiq Khan told everyone that diversity was our greatest strength. And, you know, that's that. So another terrorist attack, another stabbing in London. Does anyone on the panel, Blair, thoughts?
Well, the first thought that comes to mind is, why do they do this? Yeah. And it's easy to just say, oh, because they're psychos, because Islam, because they're just crazy people. But they are people with thought processes just like anybody else. It happens too frequently. Like when you said London's terrorist attack, I wanted to say, which one? Seriously, you have to narrow it down. But they do it because you to them are kafir. What's kafir mean? Well, Muslims have two terms for people who aren't Muslims. We know infidel, okay? But also what comes under the term infidel is also, in their language, what translates into people of the book. What that is people who are religious and who live by religious moral standards, they're just not Muslim yet. These are the convertible people to Muslims. They don't necessarily want to kill you unless they don't see any worth for you at the time, if you are a people of the book, if you fall under that category. However, kafir to them is the worst sort of human scum. Kafir are nihilistic, atheistic people who don't live by any moral standard or any godly standard. They don't believe in God at all. These people are marked for extermination by the Muslims. They are dogs without souls to them. And most of the Muslim population see the remaining white British population as kafir, people who don't go to church, people who don't understand religious moral structure, people who live for nothing but themselves. These people are irredeemable by Islamic standards, and so when they kill you, they see themselves as doing a service not just to Allah and to themselves, but to the world itself. That's why they do this, and they're going to continue to do it, even if it works against them, even if, you know, the noble Sadiq Khan needs to stand up and talk about diversity in order to, or in an effort to try to douse any flame in the hearts of the British people and make them think that there's no hope afterwards. Like, it's going to make it harder for the system of egalitarian multiculturalism to sustain itself while they're doing it, but they will continue doing it because they hate you. They look at you on a daily basis walking around with your short skirts on if you're a girl, or your tattoos and your drug habits if you're a guy, either if it's pharmaceutical drugs that you've been prescribed, and they want to kill you. They see you as kafir. You're not redeemable to them. You're living for no purpose. So if you understand that, you can understand why they're going to keep killing you and why it's something that you can just expect. So it really isn't surprising anymore. I mean, if you're going to keep letting these people into your country in large numbers, and it's not even a fact of letting them in anymore. They're already there. There's nothing you can do about it except try to segregate yourselves as a community. And I think that's the solution in Western countries, is not necessarily to fight openly and be anti-government or anti-multiculturalism or anti-anything. It's just to be pro your own community and to separate, to get away from the decadent society of diversity. So that's the thought that comes to mind, or a series of thoughts that comes to mind for me.
Shall I jump in, Mark?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. This is a question. I've got to say, tonight, all the questions haven't been panel questions up until now. They've all been specifically for Blair, but obviously this one is for the whole panel. So Patrick and Jason, please, this is your time to chime in with an answer.
I want to, before I give a brief answer, because folks get to hear from me all the time, I do want to toss out a question to Blair that I hope, Blair, you can work at some point in one of your answers as we continue the conversation. And that is your thoughts on, because I found these fascinating, perfectly in line with what I teach. And that is your thoughts on the oppression of a people and how that strengthens the people. There are two ways, I guess, or two sides of talking about that same subject, but the oppression being something that ultimately strengthens a people. And if you could work that in somewhere, it'd be fabulous. As for this anti-white in the UK and the stabbing, I spoke about it on Sunday. Absolutely sickening, of course. The most sickening part about it is not even the fact that this anti-white individual did something that was utterly predictable. What the most sickening thing was the response from the parents. And I said on Sunday's show that the big crime was that it shouldn't have been the son that had his guts spilled by this animal, but it should have been his parents. For anybody who would say that and be able to hold that position about their son really demonstrates a white noir that is absolutely crippling in them.
I'm just going to interrupt you. I don't like interrupting, but the son did write a dissertation on overrepresentation of blacks, Asians, and ethnic minority males in the prison system. He was like king of the SJWs as well.
There's no denying that. I'm not gonna try to erase his anti-whiteism, but nonetheless, the point about I made then was, in a foxhole there are no atheists. And there are no anti-whites when an anti-white is gutting you like a fish and you're reaching to pull your guts back up inside of your body and you know that your life is leaving you. You're not at that moment going to say, well, thank God, this guy, it's totally okay that he just slit me open like a fish. The moment that an anti-white's, whether they're a person but an anti-white person's loved one is murdered by one of these individuals in a very predictable way, of course, that this was going to happen by one of these people, there needs to be a shift in how you speak about the loved one that has been murdered and the animals that have murdered that loved one. If there isn't, then you are the one who really deserves to have suffered that consequence. And may God have it always be anti-whites who are the victims of their works, their efforts, their doing on our civilization. May God let it never be any of us and the people we care about that ends up being harmed by the activities of the anti-whites. But having said that, I just want to say that when it comes to Muslims or anti-white Muslims, the way that I view this, and I think is strongest for us, puts us in the best position, and Blair was alluding to that at the end of his conversation as well, statement as well. And that is that anti-white Muslims are really a subset of anti-whites. If we are concerning ourselves with the well-being of Western kind, our people, then we will protect ourselves from all anti-whites, big and small, this religion or that religion, this ideology or that ideology. They come in a lot of different flavors. And if we break them down along these different lines and say, well, this particular group or that particular group, then we end up incapacitating, crippling our people, paralyzing our people, because no one can then decide which group is really problematic, which group might be okay, which group is a little bit of a problem. Everyone who is anti-white is a problem. And we allow those out there who are anti-white to declare themselves as anti-white, and then we just accept it. So this individual, whether in his particular interpretation of his religion or he uses his religion as his justification or not, doesn't really matter, because what if it was some other anti-white with a different religion who, hating white people as well, gutted them as fish out on the streets? He didn't go to a Muslim neighborhood or an Arab neighborhood, a secular Arab neighborhood, and gut fellow Arabs who were no longer Muslim, or there are plenty of Arabs in the Washington, D.C. area who are not nearly Muslim enough for their fellow Muslims. I mean, they go to their ceremonies and whatever it is as often, I guess, as they're required, but they are not nearly Muslim enough. And if this individual was motivated purely by Islam or the teachings of that religion, he would want to punish those who are in his community who have gone astray. No, he went and found white people because he hates white people. And that is all that really should matter for us as white people, is that he is hunting, and these people out there, whether they're practicing this religion or another, are out there hunting us because of who and what we are. And it's time we stand up and defend ourselves. And I really like what Blair was saying about how, when he returns, he wants to be talking more about the verbiage and empowering people. Blair, I very warmly invite you. We've been doing this now for years, and we got the book Go Free. We have a show Going Free every Sunday at 5:30. So it's morning for you all in Australia. We have Australians who join us, and we have an enormous number of success stories. People using their, in fact, we just had one last night during the awards, where a gentleman said that he had not talked to his brother for 6 years or something like this, and they came together on Going Free. So this is the kind of thing that we are actually doing, and we warmly invite you to participate, and hope to see you in the live chat this coming Sunday, and then maybe end up having you on the show. But I will pass it on over to our great doctor here, resident doctor, Patrick Slattery. He will step away from the surgical table to give us his opinion on the stabbing. And by the way, we do now have a new meaning for shish kebab, because I understand the great white man who helped to put an end to the tragedy that was being inflicted on our people used a narwhal tusk. And that, of course, if you don't know, ladies and gentlemen, is this long, straight tusk. And he used it to sort of corral this individual. And so perhaps now we have a new meaning for shish kebab, apropos being that this individual was from the Middle East. Patrick, are you ready?
Oh, dear.
Perhaps not.
Oh, dear. It wouldn't be a show without Patrick wandering away from the computer to get his lunch or something and just forgetting about the show. So I am going to move on to the next question. Blair's now, like, he's got that look of sort of amusement and confusion on his face. Up until now, he thought we were like a really professional operation until like one of the panel just decamped and wandered off. Anyway, on to the next question. We actually have two more super chats. Russell sent $5 and said, I'm late, so excuse if already asked, but is there a push to bring endangered white South Africans into Australia? Also, salute to Mr. Cottrell's heroic work for whites.
About a year ago, I was approached by a colleague who had a friend in Sky News Australia. And he said, hey, I can get you on Sky News on a show with a guy called Adam Giles. Do you want to do it? I'm like, yeah, man, whatever. And then I got a call a couple of days later. This Sunday, we're going on live at about 8 p.m. So I suited up and I was arriving late, so I ran there, quickly put myself together, and then sat on this live show. Went for about 10 minutes, and in that show I said that there's millions of white South African farmers that are currently being targeted for murder on the basis of their race. And if we're going to talk about refugee intake, then why don't we include these people? That these people are not culturally dissimilar from us, that they can provide an enormous amount of economic infrastructural benefit to our country over a long period of time, that we have nothing to benefit by bringing these people into our country. I was banned from ever appearing on Sky News again. The host, Adam Giles, was temporarily suspended for about 12 months after having me on, and Sky News issued an apology on their Twitter page for sharing my offensive and hateful views. So that is about as much as is being done in regards to the white South African question in Australia. I think I've probably made the greatest efforts by just doing that. And was there another question as well?
No, I think that was, he just said he just wanted to congratulate you on your heroic work for white people. So, but we do have another question from a guy whose name I'm now going to horrifically mispronounce. Brynolf Malden. That is going to have to do, my friend. Thank you for the donation, but my pronunciation is terrible. We gave $15. And he asked Blair, how has the European population share of Australia declined in the last 50 years? Is ethnicity recorded in census data in Australia?
I have not seen any official statistics. I don't think it's legal to obtain statistics on the basis of race, but we can see some statistics on the basis of country of birth. And these statistics tell us that people born in Africa are committing home invasions at a rate that is 77% higher. Or 77 times higher than Australian-born people. So that's actually, what's 77 in terms of percentage? I think that's like 7,700% higher rate. But in terms of population decline, I haven't seen any statistics in regard to that. But what I can tell you is white flight is a huge phenomenon here, especially around the southeast side of Port Phillip Bay. Most white people are moving in and bunching themselves up in this area, in these areas, southeast of Melbourne, close to the water, to the extent where people are mentioning in the comments that 7,700% higher home invasion rate amongst African-born people. But you need to keep in mind that that is just country of birth too. That means that people born in Africa that come into Australia commit home invasions at that rate, higher than Australian born. That doesn't include Africans born in Australia who are doing it too. So it could even be double that. But anyway, I lost my train of thought. What was I talking about after that? I haven't even had breakfast.
You were talking about, the question was, how has the European population share of Australia declined in the last 50 years? And I think you were talking about people, about white flight and people moving to the coast.
Yeah, that's right. Now, someone before said in the comments that I was an advocate for white flight. That's not what I meant when I said that we should separate. I meant that we need to create our own communities and even have, I think, a moral religious-based structure. We need to get involved in the churches again, I think. I'm a big advocate of that. But based on what I can see, there's a tremendous ethnic transformation taking place, but we can't see any statistics because it's illegal. White flight's a big thing, but that's the best way I can answer that question.
Well, you see, white flight's an interesting thing. I just want to give my two pence on this. I'm not one for retreat, but I'm also not one for pointlessly standing and fighting when you can't win. Now, I don't think we should be abandoning large parts of the country and going off to, or I don't believe we should be abandoning Britain and going off to live in Eastern Europe. I think that's a very cowardly plan, and the people who are pushing it are very disingenuous, because the idea that the vast majority of Brits are all just going to be able to decamp, fly out to Eastern Europe, buy a house there and start a new life, that's not feasible for the vast majority of British people. But I do believe staying in places like London now is pointless. If you have our beliefs, if you are someone who wants a European ethnostate, you need to move to places where it's 90% plus white, places where the vast majority voted leave in the referendum. Go to places like that where you're going to be around like-minded people of the same ethnicity, where you can organise and where you can start building groups and support structures that believe in what we believe in. There is absolutely no point in staying in cities like London and Birmingham. Those areas can't be won now. They have to be won back. And whilst the vast majority of people cannot, and when I say vast majority, I mean overwhelming majority, 99.9%, are not going to decamp or even think of decamping to Eastern Europe to then sort of have some sort of reconquest of Britain at a later date, the vast majority of people who are our way of thinking would consider moving to one of the areas I'm talking about. So I don't believe that white flight within Britain is a bad thing. If you're going to an area to make a base, to make a community, if you're going to an area literally just to flee and lock yourself away and hide, then absolutely that is the wrong thing to do. So if you're one of these people who's like, you know what, I moved out of London, I moved to Essex, Essex is now full, now I'm moving out of Essex, then I'm going to move up to a little town or a little village in Yorkshire. Oh no, that's getting full now, so I'm going up to the borders. Borders looking a bit full, going up to Aberdeen or Inverness. Well, that's not the right thing. Running and trying to hide away is not the right thing. But a tactical withdrawal to an area where you can actually raise awareness about points and build a vibrant and powerful pro nationalist community that can then maybe even take political power at local council level, or maybe even win an MP in the future, would be an absolutely right thing to do, because London is not going to be taken back until we're in power. Birmingham isn't going to be taken back until we have far more power. Would you say that's the same in Australia, Blair? Would you say that, you know, for people who are living right next door in the center of sort of ethnically enriched ghettos, it's best for them to get out and form communities?
Absolutely. You need a central cultural hub. Like, that's why I recommended churches for people, but you're probably better off starting your own church rather than joining one of the evangelical types that are popping up all over the place. A central community hub where people can gather, make small sacrifices, and what I mean by sacrifices, just sacrifice their time to get involved in various projects and talk to each other, help each other understand, and like I said earlier, arm people with the correct responses to help grow that community network. That's why we set up our clubhouse in Moorabbin, which is in the southeast down here, about 2 years ago now, I think it was. The purpose was simply to get people together in that area to re-establish a sense of community amongst white Australian people, a sense of community that they don't have in this country anywhere else, that they're basically not allowed to have because they're all racists and they don't deserve anything like that. But yeah, I definitely agree, and that's why before I wasn't talking about white flight. If you run away, they're going to find you, these people. And when I say these people, I don't mean immigrants. I mean the people who regard immigrants as their own bioweapon against you. They hate you, these people, the architects of diversity and multiculturalism. Imagine the strongest sense of dislike you've ever liked for someone in your life. Multiply it by 10, and that's how these people feel about you every day. They want to kill you. They want to breed you out. They want you gone. And they'll do anything to accomplish it. So white flight's never going to produce any positive result in the long term, just running away for the sake of getting away from it so you can live more comfortably. Even if you go into some remote town or out in the bush somewhere, they're going to find you. Yeah. So reformation of community, and even if you just have to rent like a warehouse of some sort to create a central community or cultural hub, a physical place where people can gather on a weekly basis, I think that's the way forward for if you want to talk about long-term productivity and success.
I agree. And people are asking in the chat, well, how can we win? How can we win? Well, I know there are towns, villages, small cities in Yorkshire, in the northwest, in the southwest, which if enough of our people move to, when I say enough, you'd only need 20 families, which isn't very many, to move to one area, and that many activists could literally transform that area by just leafleting two or three times a week. It's so easy. 20, if you had 20 people living in the same council, the same council ward, and you had 20 people leafleting that a couple of times, three times a week, you'd be putting out so many leaflets that everyone would be on board. You'd literally take control, a bit of community politics. But the big issue here is when people say often, well, how can we turn it around? They often mean they don't want to turn it around. And it's not going to happen by sitting on YouTube. It's going to happen by building these community groups and showing people that they can trust us. I live in an area, and it's a really lovely area. It's out in the countryside, but there's litter everywhere. Now, imagine, you know, if we had a little community around here and we all went out one Saturday, picked up all the litter, filled giant rubble bags with it, then dumped it on the useless Labour councillor's front lawn and said, here's all the litter from the area that you never had cleaned up, you lazy git. You know, we're now in charge. He'd be appalled. Take photos of him. Shame these people. Make absolute fools of them. And once people saw you doing that, they'd be like, wow, well, I don't care what they say about these guys in the paper. You can call them whatever you want, but at least they cleaned up the litter. You know, at least they got, you know, dog poo bins put in the park. You know, at least they made sure that those vagrants who sit drinking around the kids area by the ponds, they got them moved away because they were scaring the kids and, you know, they were doing things they shouldn't there. That's how you do things. That's how you win people's support. But we do have a couple of final super chats. Boogers McGee Russell gave another $5 and said, sorry, but I must say that those Sky News are damned filth. To apologize for interviewing Mr. Cottrell because he was trying to keep white South African women and children from slaughter. Yes, indeed, the media are filth. Boogers McGee gave $10. Blair, your whiteboard vids about propaganda and various topics were an important part of my awakening and education. Thank you, and thank you to the panel as always. So there's a supporter of yours.
Yeah, thanks. They're actually really candid and not planned. That's how I got started in this whole thing. So looking back at them, I'm like, oh, God, I could have done this so much better. But, yeah, I appreciate it nonetheless. Thanks.
Excellent. Are they still available on YouTube or anywhere?
I think so. I've been locked out of my account, but I think you can still see the videos. So I think they're still there, some of them, yeah.
Okay, well, I've also pushed out your Telegram on my Telegram and on my Twitter, and I just want to remind everyone in the chat, you know, Blair is the most censored man in the history of Australia. So it's not only an amazing honour to have him here tonight, and he's been an absolutely wonderful guest, but he has had to get up at 5:30 in the morning. So the least you can do is pop over to his Telegram and give him a follow, and let's get him the following he deserves because he is doing great work. Paul M gave $10 and said, great show as always. Buy Jason's book, Born Guilty. It's outstanding. Well, there's a plug, Jason. Please tell us how people can get your excellent book.
Well, thank you very much for that super chat and that statement. And they can get it at Amazon. But they can also go to nowhiteguiltcollectibles.com and buy it directly from me and get a signature in it. nowhiteguiltcollectibles.com.
And we have one last question for Blair. We had one from David Smith, but we've already talked about white flight. And actually, we'll ask this because it is slightly different. David says, how is the policy going in Australia of forcing immigrants into rural areas and basically spreading them out to push diversity into every area? Is that happening, or are immigrants mainly just in the large cities?
No, it's definitely in the rural areas, and a lot of it's got to do with corporate greed on the part of landowners and big developers. As I talked about earlier, they're building tens or hundreds of thousands of cheap new homes that are not even really – a lot of them aren't even livable by our standards. They're the bare minimum of what is required to pass Australian building standards and the bare minimum amount of land that a human being is supposed to live on or allowed to live on. And it's greed on a tremendous scale because a lot of money is put into it. If you think about it, to buy the land necessary to build 5,000 new homes and then build those homes, you need to have a lot of money already. And a lot of these developers aren't even from Australia. They're from overseas. So Australia is literally just being bought, chopped up and sold to the highest bidder. And the people who are making this possible are naive Indians, Pakistanis from that part of the world who have a little bit of wealth, enough wealth to come here and buy a house, who are being tricked by these ambassadors that work directly for the developers that go over to India and set up little stalls in the cities and say, move to paradise, move to Australia and have a beautiful new life. And they believe it. They come over here and they buy, you know, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 brand new home, get into some debt, become a new registered debt slave on the multicultural system, And they don't realize that this country actually doesn't have a future as long as that's going on. And really, they're not coming to Australia. They're not Indians coming to Australia. There are a chunk of India being cut out, copied and pasted into Australia.
And at one time, you guys have suffered quite heavily, haven't you, with the large numbers from East Asia, specifically Vietnamese boat people?
Yeah, the Vietnamese are really based though. Like, they have rallies against communism and stuff, and they're starting to realize that there's this new. They've got their own communities. Like, they set up shop actually quite close to the city, not too far out from the city. Sometimes about half an hour drive out in the eastern inland areas like Springvale and surrounds. But they're a very quiet people. They keep to themselves, and a lot of them attended our rally earlier this year. To address the African youth crime crisis, because you know, diversity, you know, is our greatest strength. But also, these Africans are going into the Vietnamese areas and robbing them as well. They own their own shops and run their own communities, so they're troubled by that as well. Mm-hmm. They're starting to recognise, as I said, that there's this new SJW or type culture, as well as the so-called anarchists, are all actually just communists, and the Vietnamese are pretty dissatisfied with that. So we're seeing some political engagement from the hitherto politically disconnected Vietnamese communities in Australia, and they really don't cause any problem for Australia, generally speaking. I don't see them, any of them, in this area. There's not really that many of them in the city either. They stick to their own areas and their own communities. So I can't really say anything against the Vietnamese, but yeah, the bulk of the immigration system right now seems to be centered around making money for these land developers. So that's why it's amusing that the so-called anti-capitalist Marxists protesting against racism and they're all pro-immigration policy are really just helping fatten the wallets and the pockets of these filthy rich landowners and developers that are building all these cheap new homes and filling them with moderately wealthy immigrants.
Well, thank you for that. And that about brings us to the end of the show. We've had a fantastic show tonight, and we've had great numbers. I just want to say, though, we've hit just over 1,100 viewers, and then bizarrely, the stream just cut out, and we lost hundreds, and about half of the people in Entropy said their stream was cut too. This isn't the first time this has happened. It's a real low trick they were pulling, and to have 1,100 at about the halfway mark of the show meant that we were well on track to have almost record viewership, because the show just builds and builds up until the last few minutes, when we obviously get a drop off because it's ending. And we would have probably ended up with about 1,400, 1,500 viewers tonight. So, but again, we've been interfered with. But Blair has been an amazing guest, and you know, even, you know, a lot of extra credit for the fact that he had to get up at 5:30 in the morning for this, and he's been so alert and answered everyone's questions so well. So Blair, please tell us where we can find you, how we can support your work. I've got a link to your Telegram, on my Twitter, and in the show description as well. But please give us your final thoughts and tell us where we can find you and how we can contribute to your excellent work.
I'm planning to begin streaming my videos again to Telegram. And my Gab account is like my new Twitter account. So that's Gab/RealBlairCottrell. You might want to put that link in the description as well if people don't know how to spell my name. But yeah, so Gab and Telegram are the two platforms I'm operating on now. Gab won't delete me. Torb is a solid dude. He really does believe in freedom of expression, even if he doesn't fully agree with people. I really can't fault him. He's a good guy. And yeah, Telegram, I don't know who runs Telegram. Is it Russians, or does anyone know?
No, don't know.
I don't know. But, yeah, they seem to be pretty cool too. So I'll probably be on there for a while. But as of either the end of this year, in the next couple of weeks, or maybe I might wait till the holidays and the start of the new year, I'm going to begin streaming my demonstrations again. And I've put a lot more thought into how I'm going to go about it this time. So I'll be starting that at the beginning of the new year.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It's been an amazing show. And we will definitely be supporting you. And if you ever want to come back on, or if you ever have announcements to make, you'd be more than welcome. It has been a real pleasure. Jason, where can we find you, my friend, and how can we support your excellent work? And is there an after party this week?
There's an after party. It's going to be tomorrow, sometime evening, Eastern Standard Time. We hope to see you all then. I want to say that it's been a fantastic show today to be talking rational, pragmatic, sober solutions, lucid thinking, rather than what unfortunately we hear so often in the rest of the white positive sphere, all of this false sort of childish hopes and dreams for impossible achievements and desires. So it's been, I want to say to Blair, a big thank you for your service to white well-being. Good sir, thank you for everything you're doing down there. And if you would like, I put my email in our private chat. Please reach out to me and I will, if you have an address, a land address, I will happily send you my book, Go Free, for free, and help to jumpstart in any way I can the good work that you are doing in Australia, and the people who come and into your orbit, help you all in any way that I can and that we can over here in the United States. We'll be happy to do it. It's been a real pleasure having you on today and hearing you speak, and it's been a real pleasure to be with everyone in the audience. And now I pass it back to Mark before we are out of time.
Yes, because remember, the stream is also live now on radioalbion.com, which means we have to finish within 5 minutes of the allotted time, or else we're in trouble. Patrick, where can we find you and how can we contribute to your work?
Nationalbugle.com. And you can download the CoCertified app. That's the best way to support me, is to support CoCertified. It is the app that lets you know if your food is kosher certified, and increasingly, if your world, if your politicians are kosher certified, a lot of great information there. You can find my show at Republic Broadcasting. You can go to Republic Broadcasting. You can support Republic Broadcasting as well, republicbroadcasting.org.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, last things from me. Firstly, I would like to say thank you to Blair, thank you to Patrick, and thank you to Jason. There is a stream following this stream over on Unwashed's channel. He is doing a live stream now, directly after the show. If you want to go and support him, please do. He's a great chap. I am with TR Talk tomorrow night at 8 p.m. discussing the importance of ethno-nationalism. Laura was on last night. She absolutely did us proud. She is an amazing activist, and it is a true pleasure and honor to work with her as regularly as we do and to have her as part of our movement. I am going on there to follow up with Chris from TR Talk and to discuss how things are far, far deeper than TR News tell us. I will be on tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Look for announcements on my Twitter, my Telegram, etc. Please follow me on other social networks. Look out for my video on Friday. It may be on YouTube, but it might be a BitChute exclusive. It's about the London terror attack, so I'm not sure where I'm going to put that. Also, we will be having two streams next week, one pre-general election and one post-general election, featuring Morgoth, Xerius, and the lovely Laura Towler. They will be live at 7 p.m. on my channel on Monday and Friday, so keep your eyes out for that. And that just leaves me to say, if you have enjoyed the stream and you would like to make a financial contribution, you can contribute via Bitcoin. You can see the Bitcoin address in the description of the show. If you want to send me money, otherwise you can't send me money via PayPal or Super Chat, but you can write to me and I can give you my bank details if you'd like to make a transfer. And that just leaves me to say thank you to Blair, thank you to the panel, thank you to all of the people who gave such generous donations. You really do help us to keep going. And also, as always, thank you to the incredible audience. You guys make it all worthwhile. This community is exactly what we need, and we are growing so rapidly. It has been an amazing year, and to see numbers like we're getting at the moment, even with YouTube's disruption, what a white pill. What a great show. I love you all, and I will see you on Monday for our general election pre-stream, and again on Wednesday for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. See you then, guys, and have a great evening.
radioalbion.com.